Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
However, I still feel that my number one contender is worth its salt, and that is the Tree Farm.
People aren't, you know, playing the right golf course when it comes to pork chops.
So my pork chop got shifted to Best Meal Out. It was a thick boy, probably Heritage.
There's some other stuff that I'm not really remembering at the moment. We got content on there. So anything content related, just head over to thetiepodcast.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the third rendition of our year-end pod. I won't take too much of your time here today. Just a quick run through that we'll be doing a highlights of our dirt, drinking, eating, reading, and thinking, as well as our three tenets of culture, competition, and architecture. I do want to take a quick moment to say thank you so much for the support this year. We really appreciate everybody that listens into the pods, interacts through the socials, and everything else. So excited for another big year in 2024. Once again, thank you for your support. And without further delay, let's get straight to the year-end pod. Cheers.
Hello and welcome to the third edition of the Tie Podcast Year in Pod. This is still Henry Shimp. I am joined by His Highness, Mr. Walker Simus. Fired up to chat Year in Pod today, break it down, talk about what we saw, what we learned, what we heard, what we observed in 2023, how we're going to be taking that into 2024, what we're looking forward to. I will kick it to you, Mr. Simus, to give people a little bit of an outline of what we're going to chat about today. It won't be anything that'll blow anyone's socks off, but excited to be here and looking forward to the chat.
Well, thanks. Your Highness was a high honor. I don't know if I deserve that one, but dude, this is great. This is end of year pod, episode 3.
My mic is working.
Mic is working. You're, you know, rounding 2.5. So it's good to be back, and we're in the same city. We've got golf lined up tomorrow. For those of you listening to this on, I guess, Monday, this is posting Monday. Well, it'll be a mud ball filler.
Probably a little after that. Monday would be Christmas. I don't think people are going to be listening while they open presents, but somewhere in there, maybe a Boxing Day, something of that nature.
Whenever you guys are listening to this, we'll be post Old Barnwell, and we'll have certainly some takes, but further breakdown coming between OB and the Tree Farm. So that'll be fun. Just honestly, glad to be home, glad to be tying a bow on the year. And as we get into the end of year pod today, here's what we're going to cover. We've got dirt superlatives, which is, I think, going to be the crowd favorite. And I won't go into the heavy, heavy detail on those, but it'll kind of be the gift wrap version of dirt for the year. And then beyond that, of course, we're going to get into culture, competition, and architecture, as we would. And within each of those buckets, we're going to be talking about either changed opinions or priorities for 24, what our highlights were throughout the year. So that's kind of the bulk of what we're talking about today. Henry's going to lead us off with our dirt superlatives, and I will let you take it from here.
Yes, sir. So we're going to start off, of course, with a D. And today we're going to talk about two drinks that defined the year of 2023. So for me, I've always been a guy that, like, I'm not sober, yet I don't drink all that much. And what goes along with that is, like, someone asked me, like, what is your go-to drink? No answer, really. It's just like, I don't know. Like, I don't really drink that much. Like, I have some things that I like. I don't like, you know, this long list of things, but I don't have a go-to. Well, in the year 23, I have, at least for the time being, created a go-to, which is mezcal. I've been talking a lot about it. I've had a good handful of mezcal drinks this year. And, you know, it's kind of like anything else, that there's a certain direction that a mezcal drink is going to take. So I think, as much as the mezcal, it's the direction that people are going to take any sort of mezcal cocktail. But I do genuinely like mezcal, even if I'm just drinking it straight up. And so that's a new development this year, that I do have like a full answer if someone says, hey, what do you like to drink? The other thing that I like about that is like a cocktail is not a daily thing necessarily. It's about to be an hourly thing here for us. But you know, it kind of keeps you honest. So anyway, that would be one drink that it's hard to say that defined my year, but I think, you know, it feels like a somewhat seminal moment in my, you know, pretty poor drinking career, I would say. So there's that.
And also, Henry doesn't smoke. So I feel like mezcal, you're drinking and smoking in the same glass.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know,
getting a little smokiness in there. Yeah. I definitely don't smoke. That's an interesting comment. We've definitely never talked about anything like that on the pod. Okay. Number two, coffee. I mean, fucking coffee. Like what else? With this, I'm going to kind of branch this and go, you know, a little fork in the road in two different directions. Like I just have my two go-tos. It's either on days when I want a couple cups, it is the Muddle Half Calf. And then on the, this is rare, but on the few days a week where I don't have like hardly any time and I need to take, well, I usually don't have a ton of time, but I have enough to drink a cup and then maybe take one with me. On the days where it's like, I got about 15, 20 minutes here, I'm just going to like slam down a coffee and I'm gone for the rest of the day. I go full calf, and the South American Dark Roast was the winner. Dude, this year.
It's the
12 to 14 ounces of the South American Dark Roast. Other than the Mudball Half Calf is who gets the D superlative. So,
for sure.
I'm sure people are interested. They're, the South American Dark Roast, Mudball Half Calf. Like those sound interesting. Where can I find this? I mean, Walker, I'll you know, kick it to you for your D, but maybe lead us off with telling the people exactly where to go and what to do when they get there.
Fellas, if you haven't heard it before, or if this is your first time, you can head straight over to goodwalkcoffee.com. Go check out all the blends. You've got two leads here, but I highly recommend, if you like saving money, which I do, using code THETIE, that is THETIE, for 20% off. Hammer it. I was interested, you know, I wasn't sure if you were going to go coffee or not. I was glad that you included an alcoholic beverage, because I felt like that's what it had to be. But between the two of us, if we didn't cover coffee in our four, that would feel wrong. And saying water is just bullshit. So
it's bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. My two drinks of the year are going to be, number one, the Sazerac. And please remind me where we had said Sazerac, because I forgot.
We had the Sazerac at the third location of the evening, which was part of why the Sazerac sits in infamy in my brain, which was Uptown Sports Club in the Austin, Texas.
It was, I feel bad for getting the name, because it was actually quite a memorable spot to be. Pretty fun little joint they have there. However,
two Sazeracs and I would have forgotten it altogether.
Dude, that is a strong cocktail. And to be real with you, not my favorite. Like it wouldn't make my top 10 cocktails by a long shot, but I'm so glad that we did it. And, I had been eyeing it, and it was just kind of fun to check that one off the list. My second drink cocktail of the year actually showed up pretty late. I had another one in mind. So I fly into Charlotte yesterday, and we had a family event yesterday afternoon and had a weird day. Was greeted by my brother, who was making drinks, and he made me a French 75. And I'd never heard of a French 75 before. Champagne, lemon juice, a little bit of vodka, and a little bit of simple syrup. And it knocked my socks off. It was incredible. Super simple. But I want another one of those. It was very, very good. And so that was kind of a surprise kick. It knocked number two out. Coffee, of course. I could list a dozen more, but those will be my two for today. And I will toss eating your way. And we've got two for the end of year pod for eating. We've got best in-house meal. Everybody knows Thai guys like to cook. We take pride in it. It's something you simply have to do as a human. And so if you're going to do it, you might as well do it well. So we've got Bennett best in-house meal, and we've also got best meal out. So lay it on us. What you got?
Best in-house meal. I'm going to surprise nobody here. And I'll preface by saying I did genuinely think about this for a while to try to go in a different direction, but we've talked about this a lot. Like when it comes to a best, like what was the top one this year? To me, the direction you should go is like what really is burned in your mind. You know, you shouldn't have to sit there and say, God, what? Which one really was the best? Like go back to February and look through my camera roll, like all that crazy. No, it's like, what can you just not stop thinking about? Mm-hmm. And I still cannot stop thinking about this pork chop that I made in September. Dude, I swear, these Cheshire pork chops, they're made in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Well, made. They are harvested in Goldsboro, North Carolina. So I like that fact about it, that, you know, it's straight out of North Carolina. Great, great pork coming out of North Carolina for anyone who didn't know. I've had a lot of good pork chops in my life. I think people know that. I mean, you got the... Oh, God, Kurabuta, whatever. You got Heritage. I mean, there are a lot of good purveyors of the chop these days. And the Cheshire is just knocking all of them out of the park. And this one particular pork chop I made, it's just, I cooked it right. It was the right size. It was the right thickness. I don't even remember what I served with it. Probably like either rice or potatoes and something green. That's kind of just the way I get the job done. But this pork chop, I mean, it was just unbelievable. And that's all I'm going to leave you with. It is like, when I think about what was the best, it is what can I not get out of my mind? And I still cannot forget that first Cheshire pork chop that I picked up here, cooked at home. It was that good. So that's going to be my best in-house meal. And then my best meal out, kind of the same thing here. It's like, I can sit here and reel all day. If like, which one did I like the most? Was this or that? It's the one that really sticks with me. So this is early in the year, February, March, somewhere in there. Meal that I had actually with my dad in Austin. Couple business guys conducting business went out to a place called Este, kind of a seafood oriented Mexican restaurant. And, you know, when you talk about like really great food, you've got like the balance of flavor, you've got this, you got the ambiance of a restaurant, like so many different things. I think one of the last things that I'm really considering, especially when it comes to just the food specifically, is textural considerations. I particularly am fading texture because I remember when I had COVID like 2 years ago and I lost my taste and smell. I was like, oh,
that's all you got.
Textural to satisfy me. And it did like literally nothing. I was eating fucking scrambled eggs with tortilla chips and it did nothing for me. So anyway, typically texture, I think, doesn't really do a lot, but it is like, it is that final ingredient. Like if you're looking at dish A and dish B, and these are both like, you know, like if we're talking ceiling rating, you know, like these are ceiling 99s, rating like 97 and 96 and a half. Like, how are we going to kind of break some ties here? These things are awfully close. Like texture can tip the scales, I think. And so this one dish that I had in particular, it was these like spicy sauteed shrimp, shell still on, shell really crispy with homemade tortillas. I mean, get out of here. You talk about a shell on shrimp in a soft flour tortilla. Like, it's just complete game changing sort of stuff.
Game over.
Yeah. So that's where texture does, you know, come to bat. And that was the best thing I ate out this year. That's all I got.
I feel like it's such an easy knock on the pork chop, but those who knock it just have not experienced the greatness of a really good pork chop. Like, should it make best in-house meal? No. But can I believe it? You're absolutely right, I can. You did the little poll a couple weeks ago between salmon and steak, which was just never going to happen. However,
steak just absolutely rocked it.
I mean, I was keen to see the reviews and like who was voting what on that one.
Yeah, that part was interesting.
However, if you did a pork versus steak one, which we can do, I would also be interested to see what the votes look like on that one.
I think that's a tough one though, because I don't think people aren't, you know, playing the right golf course when it comes to pork chops, you know. I think people just have like the wrong sense about them, and they think a pork chop just can't be that good, you know? So it's like, well, I'm not willing to like actually spend much money to play golf. You know, I'm just going to go to this cheap ass course. They're getting just like the bone isn't even in. It's some thin little bastard. They're putting like the ranch seasoning on it, you know, something like that. Like pork chops, you know, out of the 1960s, what they're doing these days with thin pigs. Oh yeah. God damn. A nice thick one with the bone in. Get out of here.
It's too good. All right. I'm spot on. I mean, same thing with me. Best in-house meal. It was hardly even a thought. And it was dinner party lasagna. Absolutely just knocked it out of the park. And I thought to myself, is this the dish that you put the most love and soul and effort into? And the answer to this question would be yes, in my case. Made everything from the ground up and really enjoyed doing so. And you can taste it in the final product. Like, you go get a lasagna from Costco, and I'm not saying it's going to suck, but it's not going to be very good, you know? And, dude, first taste was just a joy. And everybody loved it, and it was fun to serve, and it was fun to watch people eat, and that's what dinner parties are all about. Perfect portion. I even bought a dish just to make lasagna for this many people. And it was, because I have this dish, I will continue to do it again and again and again. So we may have to do that in February. Keep you posted. Best meal out. Atchafalaya, New Orleans. I didn't have to think about this one that hard either. And the reason that I think this gets a gleaming review is because I was in a particular depression, which I was kind of hiding at dinner. But this was right after we lost in the playoff at the US four ball qualifier in New Orleans, and Henry had this restaurant planned, and I walked in, we were meeting a couple buddies there, and it was the most wonderful meal. I didn't have to look that hard at the menu. It was like gumbo. Yes, I want gumbo. And it was crack, dude. Just beautiful stuff. A little bit of white rice, humble bowl of gravy. Just so good. And that pork chop was off the charts. So my pork chop got shifted to best meal out. It was a thick boy, probably Heritage, with some pickled onions, and made it look all fancy. But they didn't have to, man. They didn't have to make it look all fancy. It was so good as it was. But yeah, wonderful space. The texture comment was good. I mean, the space was just really nice, and I probably could have ordered anything on that menu in any fashion, and it would have been excellent. So, food scene in New Orleans is just bang up. It's really solid. That's it. Best meal out. On to reading. I think this may be a long category for us both. We have two categories within reading. Book you devoured, and then book you got the most from. And I have no, if you asked me to predict what it would be for you, I would have no idea. So I'm excited to hear this one.
Yeah, I don't know how much time I'll really take here. I think I definitely, especially with book I gained the most from, went a very different direction than you did. But the book that I devoured this year, and this was actually the first book that I read in 2023. So I guess I, kind of smoked my good ones first. But River of Doubt, story about Theodore Roosevelt's voyage to the Amazon River. Just like crazy, crazy shit to think about a guy who is post-presidency. I'm pretty sure I have that right. This was after he was president. There's no way they would have let him do it while he was president, I don't believe. Maybe they would. But anyway, Theodore Roosevelt, guy who was president of the United States, goes down to the Amazon in like the early 1900s, when like that was just not a very smart thing to do necessarily, and like very nearly died. You know, the I don't know which one it is, but one of the Indiana Jones movies where he's like, you know, it looks like it's the Amazon or he's in Africa or something like that, and there are the, you know, I don't want to say Native Americans, but native peoples to the area that he's in that like are blowing like poison blow darts and things at him and all that craziness. Like, that's literally what Theodore Roosevelt was working with down there at the Amazon. And so for that to be, it doesn't feel like that should have been like a true story in a lot of ways, But not only is it a true story, but we're literally talking about a president of the United States who is the protagonist of this book. So pretty wild stuff. That was a book that I devoured.
Did he list a motivation for going down there?
He did. I don't recall. He's kind of a guy that just was all about doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
I should remember the quote, or at least the crux of it, but you know, he had just like a general philosophy around like, we're meant to do hard, interesting shit, essentially. And I think it was just along those lines of like, whether it's working out every day or something, like humans aren't meant to sit around and, you know, you are supposed to read books, but that's not all you're supposed to do. Drink coffee, read your books, and shit, I guess, go test your skills against blow darts in the Amazon. So I don't know if I'm a game that one, but there's a lot to be learned there. So that was the book that I devoured. The book that I gained the most from, I'm going to give kind of an internal plug here to a pod that we did with Jeff Shackelford. Someone that I'm glad that we did a couple podcasts with this year. I've really enjoyed getting to know Jeff more. But so his book, Golf Architecture for Normal People, I really thoroughly enjoyed that book. And even though it is meant to be, you know, almost that whole series of like, you know, blank for dummies, simplicity is oftentimes the ultimate form of complexity in my mind. You know, the way that he describes golf courses, or at least in how to think about and rate a golf course on his system of RED, red, can you remember every hole? Could you play it every day? And can you walk your dog out there? Like, are they a bunch of pricks that don't allow you to bring a dog? But also, like, is it an interesting land to where you would want to walk a dog, even if you weren't playing golf or even if there wasn't a golf course? When I sit there and think about golf courses, and particularly the ones that I like and maybe ones that I don't like, it probably, if I like it, is because it has all of those three things. And if I don't like it, it's probably because one of those is missing. Like, either they're, you know, all stuck up, or I like it, but I wouldn't want to play it every day. If I can't remember that, that's like, to me, the ultimate like litmus test for a golf course. If I can't remember three or four of the holes, the odds that I like that thing are about zero. You know, like golf courses that I love that I played 9 years ago, I could still tell you exactly what the second shot looks like on the 14th hole. And they're golf courses that I played 9 months ago that I'm like, I couldn't tell you holes 9 through 14, anything about them, you know, because they're just not very memorable. And that doesn't have that much to do with land in my mind, honestly. Yes, interesting land has a lot to do with it. It's easier to create golf holes that are memorable if you have interesting land, but you can create really memorable golf holes in the absence of it. So that's a book that I gained a lot from. I feel like it spurred on a lot of interesting conversations with other people about golf this year. And so I gained a lot from that. So again, different direction than I think where you're going to take these two questions. But that was the book that I devoured and the book that I gained the most from in 2023.
Yeah, I'm getting in the self-help grind.
Of course you are.
Here we go, baby. Buckle up. Ironically, the book that I devoured the most this year was the first one that I read this year. It's called The Creative Act, A Way of Being by Rick Rubin. And I think as you move kind of throughout your early life, I want to do more video creation and just exploring what creativity looks like. Like, what does putting creative ideas out in the world look like? And what does it look like as a final product, but also what does it look like as a process, how does it become part of your day, really? And I think that this book really helped me. I think it changed a few opinions on some things that I had. And it also helped clarify some things for me that were barriers to the things that I wanted to create. I think most meaningfully, one thing that I've realized about myself in my early adult life is that I think I care what people think about either my work or me more than I would like to admit. And this book, as far as creativity speaks, talks about how really it's not about the consumer at all. It's about purely making something that is the best version of what you can make and consistently putting that out into the world, putting the audience last. And that one quote, that one idea has really helped me just get stuff done and put stuff out and not worry too much about it, but also has really helped me and encouraged me to kind of put in the creativity reps. And I think the third thing that it did was it extended my horizon for what I think my creative life looks like. In other words, it's not just a project or the skills that I am learning now or want to learn. It's like, what do you want to go do? What do you want to go see? What do you want to go capture? What do you want to go learn about? And for a million reasons, it was the favorite book that I read this year. On a different token, the book that I think I gained the most from, I kind of picked throughout this book throughout the year. And it was a book by David DeSalvo called What Makes Your Brain Happy and Why You Should Do the Opposite. And I think the crux of that book is really everything is patterns, and everything is a feedback loop, pretty much. And I think it allowed me to take notice to the feedback loops in my life and notice them, but also understand them and kind of just pick them out. And I think it allowed me to just understand my brain better and say, no, I'm going to actively deny myself doing this because I want this. And even just speaking it out loud or just knowing why I was doing it helped me. And there weren't many things in the book that really just blew away my opinions or changed my life in any big way. But I would say that it, you know, a lot of grains of sand eventually make a beach. So that was kind of the vibe of this book and how it affected my year. So those are my two. I really don't have a great reading list for 2024. So maybe this is a good time to ask the listeners for book recommendations. If anybody wants to, feels passionate about a book they read this year or recently, go ahead and hit me in the DMs, because I really don't have a lot cooking for next year. So that's enough on the reading category. And we'll take it to thinking. Henry, what did you learn from 2023 that has formed kind of a key thought, a wave for 2024?
So I would say this is specifically more a work lesson that I have taken into kind of everything that I do in life that I particularly want to take into 24 with everything I do, which is to operate without clarity and using clarity to inform really high level intentionality with what you're doing. You're just like simply wasting your fucking time. If you aren't super clear on the task at hand and what you're trying to accomplish, and then being, once you have that clarity, being highly intentional about how you're going to go about it, the timeline for which you're putting yourself on to complete it, et cetera, there's no point in doing things. And I guess another piece of that is like the recognition that you don't always have to be doing something, because I think that this mindset of like, oh, well, it's, you know, 11 a.m. on Tuesday, you know, got to be efficient, got to be doing something. It's like, if you aren't clear on what you need to be or should be doing and don't have a really good intention behind what you're doing to accomplish something that actually matters and moves a ball forward in some bucket of your life or job, then what are you even doing? You know? So I think that's the biggest thing for me, is like, it kind of goes to efficiency of time, but it's not even that as much of just, if I'm going to do something, if I'm not clear on why I'm doing it and exactly how I'm going to do it, then there's no point in wasting my time with something. Because ultimately that's what I find, is that when I look back on things that I've done, whether it's something that I did an hour ago or something that I did for, you know, the course of a year, if I wasn't clear going into it as to how and why I was doing it and then highly intentional about it, then it's just like, ultimately I should have just never even started that, you know? So, I think that's going to be something that I am thinking a lot about going into 2024, again, in all buckets of life.
No, that hit hard. That's very true. And that exists in every bucket there is.
For example, like, I am dead fucking clear on I love pork chops. And when I throw a pork chop
and mezcal,
there is some intention behind what is going on. I am ordering a mezcal drink at the bar in a couple hours because I am clear and intentional on what that mezcal is doing for me. Okay, enough.
I'll provide another example. I've got a 45-yard pitch. The lie's a little bit iffy.
Stop it. There's zero clarity.
There's no fucking clarity.
That's
therefore,
the twilight zone.
It can go either a yard or 60. So, yeah, what is my wave, I guess? I talked about this last week for Mudball Monday, and for those listening, I think this will be 2 weeks ago. Setting a goal, identifying the problems, making a plan, and finding peace in executing that plan aggressively. Like, you remember that video of Tiger? There are a million of them, but he was explaining his process of playing golf. How many flagsticks do you aim at? None. I aim at no flagsticks. I never aim at flagsticks. Maybe once in my career I've aimed at a flagstick. I aim to my spot, but I play aggressively to that spot. And boy, oh boy, is that true in life. And to be real with you, exactly what I just said is the same thing that you said, just said in a very different way. You have to have a goal. You have to know what the problems are before you make a plan. You have to have a plan. And my God, if you've already done that, you better execute on it. And both of us today, combined with everybody listening, has failed at that plan many, many times. And that's fine. I failed a lot this year, and I'll fail a lot next year, and that's cool. But, you know, you've got to take inventory. And I will say, last year, I was really disappointed with my year in a couple areas. And this year, there's been some great progress in a lot of buckets, and I look forward to what this year brings. But that's been mine. I would say two other little add-ons would be ask simple, specific questions to only the people who know the answers. That's for me. And then another thing that I'm working on is just seeking more feedback, because I don't think I do it enough. More feedback, more often. Implement the feedback. So that's it. Let's move on to some culture, competition, architecture talk.
Yeah, let's flip it here. How about you lead us off with culture, and and I'll come behind.
Man, pretty easy answer for me. The Ringer was really the culture highlight of the year. I was very, very glad to see and play Tree Farm 18 holes for the first time. And you know, I was just reflecting on, like, it's been 5+ years. It's probably been 10, but I didn't even know Zach Blair back then. Since the Buck Club was an idea, since we started seeing golf holes being drawn on Instagram and photos of Zach, you know, traversing rocky land in Utah, planning a golf course, and the first routing that King Collins did, the second routing that King Collins did, all the ringers, all the people who put a lot of time, energy, and effort into this project. And to be out there with not everybody, but over 100 of them who supported the project, it was further clarity that it takes a village, but it was also cool to see how, not just at the ringer, but throughout time, you know, There are a dozen or so people who have been involved with that project, who have been there start to finish, late nights, a lot of flights, a lot of time on site. I think all of those rhymed, which is not bad. and have really put a lot of soul into that thing. And it was just cool to see that. It was so evident. And going back to a little bit of my thinking, I mean, I learned a lot from Zach this year. He's really good at seeking feedback. He consistently asks. The other thing is he's just not afraid to get started. Like he started with Buck Club. He consistently drew golf holes. He was always talking to people, and to see it finished or nearly finished, and to know what went into that was just really special. I think it was the first project that I'd really seen go from a thought to more or less a finished product, which was awesome. And then I guess lastly, everything he does, like there's a lot of effort put into that thing, but the reason why is because he just wanted people to have a good time out there. And I feel like he really accomplished that, which was cool. So what a time to be out there. It was an incredible couple days. Golf course plays fantastic. It'll only get better over time. Staff just seems to be all class. Just really nice. So what about you?
My cultural event of the year, and this probably is a little funky, but it also shows just like stage of life sort of stuff. The US Amateur was my cultural event of the year. Yeah, it was competition. Yeah, it was architecture. It was a lot of different things. But to me, what really kind of came out of that week was just like being among the competitive scene once again. It was the first time I competed in, I don't know, 14 months or something. Yeah, somewhere in there at the time at which I, in a real tournament, when I ended up pegging it there. And being out in Denver was awesome. I mean, I hadn't been to Denver for quite a while. There's a reason that people talk so highly of it. Really great city, especially in the summer. It was a cool first experience of being out of school, but also not old enough yet to where like still close to a lot of my former teammates and like other guys who are still in college who are, you know, 2, 3, 4 years younger, and kind of giving me the like, what exactly are you doing here? And it's like, yeah, I don't know. Like, that's a great question, but I'm here and we'll see how things go. So that felt like a highly cultural experience, even though there was some competition in there as well. But yeah, just a really, really fun week to have, you know, a couple of really good friends around, and, you know, had some really great dinners. And Cherry Hills, we've talked about a ton, just a gym, super fun to get to compete there. And just always fun to get to play in a USGA event. And so, that was definitely a competitive highlight. But I really take kind of the culture side of that week away a little bit more. And so that's going to get the nod for me for cultural event of the year.
Competition. I would say we've got two here. We've got kind of best moment personally, of which I don't have many to choose from. And then non-personally, something we observed this year that in the spirit of competition, you know, lit up the dopamine receptors. I've really got two big takeaways here as far as best moment personally, and they both come from New Orleans. And that was that I really enjoyed the reminder of how hard golf is when it matters. And secondly, I really enjoy the feeling of performing under pressure, even when that's fleeting or only experienced for a moment. It's like it's a feeling that is worth chasing, worth having. And man, I got humbled on that front nine. It was so bad, dude. It was so bad. And
it was bad.
It was really bad. And like, I felt it was weird because you need a couple things when you play golf. Like you need a little bit of nuance, and you need to understand what's going on. And like, if you're missing one of those, it's a little tough. But if you're missing both of those, it's just not going to work. Like, it's just not. And for the front nine, I was missing at least both of those. And even with a disciplined mind, I just don't think you can really do much. And then on the back nine, I got some life back in me and hit some good shots. And there were a couple in particular that were, you know, like actually quite good.
You hit a few really good shots on the back.
And those, you know, we had some unfortunate missed putts and things of that nature, and you coulda, woulda, shoulda your way all the way home. But it was just, it was fun to get both doses. It was fun to get, fuck, man, it's a long way from here to really good, basically. And then on the other end, it was like, hey, there's still a little bit of really good in there. And so, you know, you just have to make that decision of, I'm facing that right now. It's like, how much mid-am golf do I want to play? And why, you know? And I think some of that's yet to be determined. I think people have asked me that a lot this year. They're like, why don't you just dive into the Florida mid-am scene? And for me, I like this year, next year, probably couldn't justify a full FSGA schedule. And in my opinion, if you're not really committed to doing it, there's not much point in doing it. But I'm acknowledging at this point that, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't last forever. And so maybe it's time to get my feet wet a little bit and start playing again. So that was what I learned on the personal side. And then non-personally, God, I just want to shit on everybody and just go full Michael Block. We'll get there in a minute. I really thought that Eric Van Rooyen's story with his friend who was battling melanoma and then passed away a couple days after the tournament in Mexico, that was pretty awesome. I read a book, I think it was in 21, called The Power of the Other. And the opening section of the book, essentially the introduction, was about two guys. And they were off the coast of some island, and this guy was going to drown. Like he had nothing left. They had been treading water for hours. And by the grace of God, a little bit of human connection, this guy was able to make it to shore and wrote a story about it. And I thought it was just so cool how he really needed to play well that week. Like he really did. It was important. He was right on the 125 line. And you don't want to push that sort of thing. Like you do not want to push. You don't want to delay the I'm on the 125 line towards the end of the season. That gets gnarly, especially on your noggin. And he was just saying how hearing about where his buddy was, his former teammate was with his health, realizing that he only had about a week to live, just totally took all that away. And I thought that was pretty special. But on a more just bullshit note, Michael Block, it was the year of Michael Block, brother. I mean,
he
took it over and,
oh,
and very well, I could say that 24 is his year too. I just don't think he's going away. I think we're going to know Michael Block for a long, long time. I think we just met Michael Block in 23. So that was his year. Whether you like it or not, he earned that shit. But in 24, I may have a heavier hammer, we'll say.
I think I'm going to start with that hammer by saying, you know, I guess you hear the term silence is compliance. I am going to flip the narrative there and say Blocky wants to be talked about, and I am actively not talking about Block because that is proving it was the year of Michael Block. And so he is getting no further coverage on this podcast. Block, no more Block, at least for 2023. And this is our last podcast of 23, so you can figure that out for yourselves. But anyway, no more Block today. Okay, competition. Yeah, you know, I'm kind of like going off the same thing here, but qualifying for the U.S. Amateur was like a completely different experience than playing in the U.S. Amateur, I have to say. That was, I guess, I said the first U.S. Amateur was the first time I competed. That was the first like real event that I played in, but you know, the qualifier was a month prior or so. And I mean, I hadn't done anything competitive, like with pencil in hand, in 13 months at the point at which I did that. So that was a true, like, you know, I was playing Sand Hills the next day. Frankly, that's the reason I was doing this qualifier.
You were supposed to play Sand Hills the next day.
Yeah. That had a lot more to do with with me being there, frankly, than like, oh yeah, I'm actually going to go qualify for the US Amateur. It was more of just like, well, I've heard Wild Horse is cool, so like, I'll go do that. You know, just we'll see what happens. Truly, like, no idea, right? And I got out there and just like started to play pretty, like, just solid golf to where I was like, okay, like, this isn't that bad. But there weren't a bunch of signs saying like, look, there are only 85, there are only two spots in a field of 85 guys. Like, first 18 holes or so, there weren't a ton of signs saying like, I'm getting ready to, you know, turn on the engines and actually go like qualify for this thing. And it was one of those kind of one in 10 days where I was just like, why not just try to go shoot 30? And on the third nine, I think I did shoot 30, 31, something like that. That was a pretty fun experience. I mean, that was a competitive highlight of the year and probably the last couple years. You know, especially just like I said, like really not having any idea what sort of stuff I was going to have to, and I kind of hate doing this, sitting here like pumping my own tires for 2 minutes straight, but to go holes, what, 2 through 7 or 8 or so, and like make 5 birdies in 6 holes or something like that. Yeah, that was fun. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And then most importantly, like formally being under the gun for, you know, 3 hours more or less. Because by the eighth hole or so, I was like, okay, well, now I'm formally part of the storyline. And then, of course, ended up going into a playoff the next day, all that jazz. But yeah, that was really enjoyable to get to play well. But then also, it was more product of like what comes with that, of like actually having to be under pressure and hit some 5-footers. We were like, all right, like, you know, this is consequential, at least in my tiny little world of trying to qualify for the US Amateur here whilst, you know, we got these live boys signing 9-figure contracts. So that's
read the story. It was my favorite story of the year for you. It was great. So if you haven't read it, go read it.
Thank you. That is, I don't know if we have a www dot or not, but thetiepodcast.com. Easy to get there. Yeah. A lot of stuff on there. You can get all of our podcast, all of our writing. There's some other stuff that I'm not really remembering at the moment, but we got content on there. So anything content related, just head over to thetiepodcast.com. Okay. Best moment for me non-personally this year. And I guess this is still like somewhat personal to me. But first year that I was not a part of the Stanford golf team in which they were competed and, you know, made it to the national championship and all that craziness. The first time I like actually had watched since, shoot, it's kind of crazy that my two timestamps are, I remember tracking the scores in like, and there were years in between this as well, but like when they were on TV, 2014, when Patrick Rogers was on the team, playing at Prairie Dunes, Maverick McNeely, Cameron Wilson won that year. I remember watching that one on TV, and then, you know, fast forward to 2023 was the next time I recall us being on TV that I was not involved, to where I was actually watching. Oh my God, dude. Like, nothing really makes me nervous in terms of watching sports, which is a product of just not like, I have teams and things that I care about. Cat, that's a little bit different story. If Cat's playing, then, that would make me nervous, but bit of the sign of the times that I haven't been nervous about watching Cat play golf for a while. Apologies, the PNC doesn't like quite get me tingling. But you know, I don't really have a basketball or football team where I'm like really, really, you know, slugging to watch them play. Watching Stanford in the match play playoff, they were in a playoff with Arizona State to get the final match play spot, which unfortunately did not fall our direction. But I was like fucking hyperventilating sitting there on the couch watching, because it actually was one of the crazier things I'd ever witnessed, in that you send 5 guys out on 5 different holes and then sum up the scores. And so it is just like the full, I'll use the term, sensory overload of like this golf shot, that golf shot, like it's all happening simultaneously. And all of it is like 100% consequential. Like all of these shots matter. You don't get to kick out any scores. It's just sum all of them up. And so it's like, if someone ropes one in the water or something, it's like, this thing might be over. And then like, there was a chip in, there were like really good pitch shots. There were some short putts that were missed. It was just like, I truly could not do it. And I hadn't had a sporting experience like that, like watching something that made me that nervous, literally since like probably middle or high school, watching basketball games that I used to care a lot more about, things of that nature. So, that was probably, I don't know if that's even like my best moment. In fact, it's almost certainly not, but it's the most vivid moment in my mind from watching sports this year, particularly watching golf this year. So, again, no Michael Block commentary, from my end. I've done more than enough of that this year. So move on from competition, hit our last bucket of the day with a little bit of architecture. Again, we've got two things here. We've got a, what did you change your mind on this year in the world of architecture? And then, excuse me, we have three things this year. Best new course to you this year. This could be a new course altogether or something that's new to you. And then finally, what are we most excited for in 2024 in the world of architecture?
Cool. Which order do you want them in? You want a best new course in 23 to lead?
The world is yours, Mr. Simus, Your Highness.
I love that. My sample set is a little bit lacking in 23, which is a call to action to myself in 24. We got to make that bigger. However, I still feel that my number one contender is worth its salt, and that is the tree farm. It's really good. We talked a lot through construction, and to a certain degree, it's a little bit hard to tell what the final product's going to be. It's always a little bit of a mystery until everything's grassed. But, you know, Kai Golby and his team did a wonderful job out there. And it could have been a lot of things. Tree Farm could have been a lot of things. And it's not crazy long. It's long enough. It could be more wild. It could be sexier. But when you string it all together, when you combine it all, it's truly special. So it's a really, really good golf course, and it's a really fun golf course to play. And I think Zach would be pleased to hear this. It's a place with a very, very strong sense of identity, which is something that a lot of courses miss out on. And that all started from the beginning. So that was my best new to you course in 23.
One question next for you there. I love tacking one word along with a golf course. What is the one word that you would put with either the architecture, or, you know, you talk about the sense of identity. Is there one word to you that sticks out in your mind with the tree farm?
Range. It's got range. It's got short. It's got long. I mean, it's got big and it's got small too. I mean, you think about 13. I think 13 is 14 acres, which is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's certifiably insane. And the 17th is 126 yards, and it's one of the best par threes I've played in a while. And when it really gets cooked out, or just firm in the wintertime, both, it's pretty scary shot, especially when that pin's on the right, or if it's in the front. And it's hard to get those two things right, get them to all make sense together. So
17's even more scary when it's like 46 degrees.
Range.
The wind is into off the left. You need to hit a tight draw into that wind. And you know that there is zero part of tight nor draw in your ball flight that day. You're just like, okay, I'm going to be in that bunker. And let's just hope that the ball doesn't plug. That's what it looked like for me.
I've never owned a tight draw ever. Not once.
No, you haven't.
No. It's actually kind of a better hole for me. But not by much. Distance matters too. And balloon balls don't work. So
there are a lot of things that matter. But we'll move on from that conversation and talk about something you changed your mind on this year.
Yeah. Bunkers. Maintenance. I would say maintenance, working with superintendents and learning more from people who know a lot about architecture and learning how maintenance influences good design. That was the crux of what changed a lot of opinions that I had. I don't think I changed my opinions on too many things, but I would say most importantly, I just am amazed that we have so many bunkers in the United States. It seems ridiculous. One thing Mike Clayton talks about a lot is how we take the most nonsensical things from Augusta, but we don't take the obvious, aka width, opening to greens, and
egg salad.
the right sandwich. The right Thompson sandwich. Now, and the third thing being just they have like two cuts, you know, like everybody should, or most people should at least entertain the thought of having, you know, one or two cuts on their golf course versus three or four. Yet we take the most idiotic things that are expensive and hard to replicate. Perfect grass, crystal white sand, sub-air systems, drainage practices, things of that nature. It's like, why? Why do we do this? And when you put the same principle and you take a golf course in the United States versus Scotland, like, why do bunkers in the United States have as many or more bunkers than they do in Scotland? To me, that makes absolutely no sense. They're more expensive to produce. They're more expensive to maintain. They're more expensive to drain. And better players love them and worse players hate them. Like, it makes no sense. And I would love to see less effort put into bunkers in construction or on maintenance. And I would love to see that effort be reallocated into ground contour. And I'll share a quote from McKenzie. All bunkers are eliminated that do not add materially to the pleasure of my courses, as my courses have only a quarter the usual number of sand traps. The cost of maintenance is correspondingly reduced. So it did not come from me. And I'll list some examples. I think Congressional has a lot of money, and I really enjoyed the competitive play that's gone on there since they did the renovation. But my God, they're doing too much. There are too many bunkers out there. It's a lot to look at. I think the ground contour is interesting, but they did too much. Now, here's a better example. Oakland Hills, they have massive bunkers, but there are less of them. They're bigger, they're flatter, they're easier for maintenance, and they still provide that pop. And then we were just talking about the tree farm. The amount of restraint that was used there on a sandy site in a region that has a lot of sandy scrub and bunkers and Pinehurst type golf courses, the restraint there was admirable. Like, it was pretty amazing how few bunkers they chose to put out there. And I thought that was really cool. For the record, you know, I haven't played Old Barnwell yet, but I've been out there quite a bit. The bunkering there is special, and it kind of breaks the rule that I just mentioned. However, I think that's some of the best bunkering we've seen on the East Coast since National Golf Links. That may be bold, but I think it's true. So there are exceptions to this rule, but I would just say for the majority of courses in the U.S., too many bunkers. Think about eliminating them. And then what am I most excited for in 24? There's one project that I really don't want to speak on, but I'll give you a state, and it's in Martin County in Florida, and it is really exciting, and there's some really special people involved, and I'm excited to come to light. I'm excited to show you guys more about it. But the one that I can publicly state that I'm very excited about in 2024, mostly because it's a vehicle for us to consume some really good pizza, but also because Gill and Company is doing some really exciting work at the Yale Golf Course. And I think that's going to be a project that will be, let's just call it top five for Gill when he shuts it all down. Gill and Co. But I think it's
going to be... We talking Simon Holt top five?
Yeah, like, yeah, top...
True top five. Okay, just top five.
But I think, yeah, Simon Holt top five.
Just top five, yeah, gotcha.
But I think it's going to be on the short list of when they look back and think about the incredible work that they put out the last, well, however many years, once they decide to shut it down or change things around. I think that Yale is going to make that short list. I don't know if it'll be 5 or 10, but it'll be a short enough list for it to be a headliner. So tossing it to you, architecture, close this out.
Yeah, one thing that's important here that you talked about there. I've never thought about this before, but is pizza crust, pizza dough, is that a vehicle, or is pizza the whole thing just its own sort of entity? Can we not really decouple sauce and cheese and toppings with crust?
Pizza is not a vehicle because I don't think
it is either.
I don't personally, and I will, if anybody here is offended by this, continue to be offended. I don't like people who load their, take pizza as an opportunity to load it up, put all the toppings on. We don't want weight. We want quality. Quality spread, super thin. If you want more, have another pizza. Don't pile it up higher. Pizza is not a vehicle. So, yeah.
Good effort. Yeah, you know, I'm gonna raise you one there and say, we talked last year, and god damn, that was just an episode of infamy. But Thanksgiving, Mudball Monday last year, we talked about how pumpkin pie, for all intents and purposes, is a vehicle for whipped cream. And that's yeah. and that's bullshit. And I think for a list of people that's all too long that you know may put on like the FBI's 10 most wanted, pizza can be a vehicle for ranch. And that's not bullshit. That's whatever comes beyond bullshit. That's what that is. Like if you're a ranch person, just in general for pizza, that is ranch. I'm not like here to hate on ranch. I'm not really a user, but it's, you know, in the right context, it can have its purpose in the world. But if you're a ranch on pizza person, get the hell out of here. Like if pizza isn't providing you enough, no, I can't do it. So that's pizza talk for the day.
To me, that feels like adding sugar to your Coca-Cola or something. Like you can't do that.
No. Yeah. You really can't do that. Can't okay. Do that. All right. Architecture. I might go a different order than you. I'm going to start with what I changed my mind on this year. So this is like partially a product of environment. Me growing up a little bit. I don't really know exactly, but, and I'm still by no means a conditions with regard to aesthetics sort of person. I think a lot of people, they want to just see a green, lush golf course, you know, and it's like just looking at it, it's beautiful. That's bullshit. Okay. We're talking a lot of bullshit these days. I'm not there for that. What I will say is, as a guy, and I think you can probably relate to this as well, as a guy who now still plays a lot of great golf, I still get to play a lot of great golf courses. I also play some dog shit golf courses pretty regularly. And
yeah,
I have a new appreciation for conditions. Like when you start playing golf on courses where fairways have to be really, really bad for it to be like truly detracting from the experience. Like it's got to be bad, bad. Now really good fairways are a lot more enjoyable than like decent fairways, but the big one for me is greens. Like I'll go a couple months straight and play golf three or four times, and it's like, man, I haven't hit a putt in 8 weeks where I'm like, I actually expect to make this because the greens are that bad. You know, mm-hmm. like when greens are bumpy and rolling six, and that's all you see for like 75 straight days, like that starts to kind of wear on you a little bit, and your appreciation for the conditioning of a golf course really takes a step up. So I don't know if that's a changing of my mind necessarily. I guess it is from the standpoint that, like, if it comes to public golf, and I'm never going to pay all that much just in general, but like I would probably consider paying for conditioning just because it's like, look, I'd rather pay $75 somewhere to like actually be able to go like take some value in the strokes that I make on the green versus pay $40 to be like, okay, like I can hit the ball today, but like these greens are so bad, truly, like from 12 feet, like it doesn't matter. You know, I'm reading a foot of break, but I know it's like not actually going to get to the hole or actually take the break. So it's just like, whatever. Also, and this isn't a changing of my mind necessarily, but I continue to believe that truly proper conditioning, like high class conditioning, and again, this has nothing to do with aesthetics or the color of the grass. If I can make the grass black for all I care. And on that note, I'm a big fan of the like charcoal treatment. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? A lot of courses will put like it's like charcoal that's ground up because it really keeps a lot of warmth in the ground. and it helps like firm up a golf course. I wish I had a better description of this, but it's a thing.
Let's talk about this over drinks.
Yeah, we'll do. Maybe I'll do a little research here before we do so. But anyway, a golf course that truly is conditioned properly with regard to the architecture. I talk about this all the time, but it just never ceases to amaze me how much that elevates the experience. Like you can take a golf course that at face value, the conditioning is going to be, you know, the floor is like a 93, you know, so something somewhere where it's just going to be good. But then it being firm, which in my mind pushes it up to, you know, a 98 or something versus it being, yeah, really good, really lush, but kind of a little bit softer where it's at that 94.5. Like it elevates that experience so much in terms of, you know, now, and I have a greater appreciation as well now for like what true difficulty is because I kind of suck. Like,
yeah,
when you're pretty good, whatever that's supposed to mean, I don't know if I ever was any good, but like when from 100 yards, you kind of know you're going to nip it and the ball's going to spin. And it's more just a question of like, am I going to be within like 8 yards of the flag or am I going to be within 1 yard? You know, like that's one thing. But when you're standing over on a 100 yarder and you're like, I don't know if I'm going to hit this half decent or not. When a golf course is firm, like that's now we're really talking about like, am I going to hit the green or not? You know, like it just, it elevates the experience to a completely different level. So that's something I just continue to have greater and greater appreciation for over the years. Just how much more, to me, it's enjoyable. I guess you could flip it the other way and say, well, how the hell is that enjoyable? It's enjoyable for it to be easy, but I'm not really here for that. So that is what it is. That is something I've kind of changed my mind on this year and something I kind of just turned into me blowing a bunch of smoke about whatever. Writing off that, I have to do the best course that was new to me in 23. And so the obvious answer, if we're talking rankings or just like purely what is the course that I personally am going to rank it, go read the top 25 golf courses of Christmas. We finished up with that now. It was number 7 for me, Sandhills. I mean, that was objectively, I guess, the best new course to me in 23, but the course I'm going to talk about here, because this comes more from a standpoint of what course exceeded expectations by the greatest amount the most for me this year. The answer there is Valley Club of Montecito. This is a place that I knew it was good, and the ratings were like, they were strong. People were just like, yeah, you're gonna like Valley Club, like it's really good. But I feel that people undersold it in certain ways. And I don't know why that is necessarily. Maybe it's a product of what I was just saying, that it is a course that was just like so unbelievably firm, and maybe some of the difficulty that brings out in it on certain types of shots or something is something where people are like, this is just like not that fun. Whereas I look at that and say like, this is just fantastic to have to like hit a proper ass shot. Basically any time you have a wedge in your hand.
Yeah.
I was just so blown away by how much I enjoyed that place. It really did almost play Sandbelt-esque, which is something I really hadn't seen in the States before. And I mean, if you can imagine having no sense of what Sandbelt golf looks like, and if you just showed up and you're like, what is this? Like, I've never thought of this, right?
Yeah.
To a slight degree, that's what it felt like showing up at Valley Club, because I did like it. It almost surprised the upside more than like from a novelty standpoint than the Sandbelt did, because I knew kind of like the times that I've been to Australia, like you kind of know what you're going to get. Yeah. You've never been there, but you know what it looks like. You kind of have your sensibilities about what it's going to play like. You just have to go do it. Valley Club, I was like, I know it's McKenzie. I know it's California. I've played, you know, 1,000 rounds of golf in California. I know people really like it, but I did not expect it to be like Sandbelt type stuff. I was kind of thinking like SFGC, honestly, and I love SFGC, but you've played SFGC, and if you can imagine that being like Sandbelt type firm stuff,
yeah, it would just
blow your mind.
And SFGC was wonderful, but it wasn't Sandbelt.
Yeah,
and it's just a hard thing to achieve.
So that was the best new for me in 23, again, from a standpoint of course that really surprised to the upside, just in a massive way, probably about as much as any course I can really think that I've ever played has. Most excited for in 2024 in architecture, same as you. I have two things here. One of which I cannot share too much on, both of which are in Texas. The one that I can't share about, I'm not talking location, but I've seen it. Some pretty gnarly land for golf. That's going to be just, it can't not be good with who's doing it. And it's going to be awesome. Just very excited for that. And some other things that I've heard about, the one that you talked about, and this whole, it's so interesting to me. There's such a dichotomy of like pictures, drone, reels, all of this, like get it out there, build the excitement. And then you have this other camp of golf courses. This is new builds that it's like, no, hush, hush. We're not talking about it. We don't want people to know who's doing it. We don't want them talking about it. I find those two camps interesting. I don't think one is right or wrong, but I just think it's really interesting that people go about it different ways. I'm here for it all, honestly. Build good golf and more of it. I love it. The project that I will speak briefly on, Luling, about 45, 50 minutes outside of Austin, more great land. Love the guy who's doing it, a friend of mine in Austin. He has, you know, a lot of great opinions about golf and other things in general. And so have full confidence that he'll execute an awesome project. And I think the reason I'm most excited for that project is in the second golf course, I don't know if this is public information yet, so I won't share, but went in a really cool direction with the second course. A firm that has done some work in the States, but also elsewhere. And thought it was an awesome choice. And then Kyle Franz doing the first course. And that, yeah. So Luling is where I'm focusing in on here. But I think at a macro level, I'm really excited to see some Kyle Franz original work. You know,
yeah,
Pinehurst, Mid Pines, Southern Pines, Pine Needles, Country Club of Charleston, Raleigh Country Club. He's done so much good restoration, renovation, whatever you want to call it, work. And I think Kyle's a really smart and talented guy. But at least as far as I know, I'm not familiar with any new work really that he's done. And so Cabot Citrus, Luling, Broomsedge. There's some really cool Kyle Franz projects going up, and I've heard some really cool things about the direction that he wants to take architecture. And it's going to be really neat to see what he puts in the ground. And so, you know, Luling is a big budget project that gives Kyle, you know, a lot of runway. And that's exciting because I think that a lot of the stuff that he's done in the past and kind of what he's built his name on is not big budget stuff. And he's knocked a lot of things out of the park, you know, kind of adding it up day to day. So, can only imagine what he's got in the tank when it's a little bit more of build great golf and, you know, let's see how great it can be.
I've spent a lot of time around Kyle this year and he is a workhorse. Like, pick a day, you know, next Thursday, sometime around 6 p.m., the sun's going down. Like, Kyle's going to be there. He's there on site at sundown every day with his crew, and they talk about ideas and get shit done. And it's been cool to see him out in the wild like that. And you're right. I didn't really think about it that way, but between those three projects, I guess you never really know what somebody's fully capable of until they have an open canvas. And his restoration work is great, but you're right. I mean, some of the shit out there at Karoo is bonkers, dude. And I don't think bonkers is the best way to go every time, but this one should be. Like, the piece of land they have out there makes sense. But I'm excited to see the range of his designs. It'll be cool.
Well, we're at this interesting spot with architecture, with all these new builds where, you know, you have the guys who to some degree do what they do, and they do it incredibly well, and they have for a long time, and they've made their name. And unless something goes woefully wrong, which it just won't, it's going to be good. You know, the Dokes and Gills and Corbin Crenshaws of the world, like, their stuff's just going to be great. You know, when they get the right budget, when they get the right land, there's a 99.9% chance that virtually every golf hole is going to be strong to quite strong, right? And then you've got some newer names that are starting to come up, and they're getting really cool, interesting projects that they're doing. And so I think by definition, it necessitates people trying some different things. If mm-hmm. you're going to play it straight down the middle every single time, now playing it down the middle and doing it right, you know, the kind of the way you spoke about the tree farm, that might be the game that wins 5 or 6 years from now. But when we talk about, you know, out of the gates, I think that it does push people to do some different things to create a bit of a difference for themselves and create that name. And so I think that's part of why this is such an exciting time for architecture, because yes, we still have the old guard of great architects getting more and more great work and doing incredible things. But, mm-hmm. you know, who of these newer names from both a course and architect standpoint is really going to stand out? You know, let's talk about it in 3 years and kind of see what some of these things turn out to be. It's going to be really fun. On that note, I want to ask you one more question today that we didn't have on the agenda. If you had one round of golf to play in 2024, this can be something that has already opened up or something that you know is going to open up in 24. You only get to see one of these new places. What one round are you playing? And I'll throw in that you can, if it's a 36 hole facility, you can play both.
I want you, me, and Trevor Dormer to walk around Cabot, St. Lucia, Point Hardy.
That's a great answer.
I don't want to give Golf Digest any more publicity than they already have, but I watched the 18-hole video yesterday, and it blew my socks off. And Trevor and I have had some DMs. I'm trying to get him to write a piece right now on Point Hardy, and now that Bill Kaur has kind of spoken on some of the difficulties that they had throughout that project, I'd really like to hear Trevor's perspective on it. And that's something I'm working on. However, there's some Cypress level shit out there. Seriously. Like it is crazy. And the holes that get you from point A to point B are still interesting enough. And I think once that place really grows into its landscape, dude, what they're doing over there at Cabot, I don't necessarily like it all, but it's kind of hard to deny the scale and the quality of what they're doing. And Highlands is going to be a whole nother thing. I don't know anything about Highlands, but that would be my easy pick. It has more to do with Trevor than Highlands. I want to get into the smells and I want to get into the weeds, you know, but that would be my easy pick. What about you? I have two questions for you. I want to know a course that you want to play next year, but I also want to hear about your competitive schedule in 2024. What's the ethos behind this year competitively?
Well, I'll start with the first one, and this will play into my competitive play, not next year, but down the line. Was so fired up to see the Lido get announced for the 2026 US Mid-Am.
Fuck, so, dude, Lido's another one.
We got to get a practice round in, baby. So that's 2024 that I would say the Lido. I actually know a lot about the, and I mean, shit, it's what it is. But I was going to say I know a lot about the original Lido. I have not pored over the pictures and reels and things that have been done on what's up in Wisconsin. But yeah, I'm planning on being there in 26. So might as well, you know, turn that into my round next year. So many ways I could have gone with that question. But that's what I'll go with. On the competitive front, I will be in Tampa for the Gasparilla, which is like, I'm really glad that that's in 2 months, which shit, that's closer than I want it to be. If that was in like 3 weeks, I would be like, you know, it'd be withdrawal season. I don't know what a golf club is right now. It's bad, bad. But so that's number one. There been some things floated to me on like the four ball front. Might do a couple things there. Some of the mid-am kind of cocktail tour events, a few of those that I'm deciding, I can't play everything. And so trying to decide which ones I want to do, it'll have a lot to do with golf course. That's for sure. And then, you know, just a couple qualifiers, try to see what happens with the US amateur, certainly the US mid amateur. I'll play US Open local just to see what happens. You never know. So the hope would be if I could play three mid-am events, let's call it one auxiliary event, like a four ball or something like that, and then slide into a USGA, I'd feel pretty good about that. And also maybe, I mean, it, you know, it's kind of like if you give a mouse a cookie, but I might do one like real amateur event as well, whether it's the Northeast or the North South or one of the Palmetto, one of those sorts of things. I might go try my hand at one other real event. A lot of those things are highly contingent on, like, if I'm playing like half decent golf in April, like if I'm hitting some shots where I'm like, that's kind of nice, then like I'll probably be signing up for something. But homie, if it was April 1 right now, I'd be looking at how much I can get for my
Groundhog Day
today, as opposed to yeah. as opposed to signing up for tournaments. So
can you feel the bounce? Can you see the bottom? Back in your hole.
Oh, yeah, seriously. So, okay. Year end pod.
This was fun. That's enough.
More to come. 2024. It's upon us.
Thank you all for being here.
2023. Appreciate the support as always. Hope you'll stick with us for 2024. That's all we got.
Bring a friend.